You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. Joining me on the line is Robert Muse, Senior Trial Counsel for the Thomas More Law Center, a nonprofit public interest law firm dedicated to the defense and promotion of Christian religious freedom, time-honored family values, and the sanctity of human life. The Law Center's purpose is to be the sword and shield for people of faith, providing legal representation without charge to defend and protect Christians and their religious beliefs in the public square. The Law Center achieves this goal principally through litigation, seeking out significant cases consistent with their mission, where their expertise can be of service to others. Thanks for joining us today, Robert.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Robert, you have a background in the military, don't you?
I do. I'm very proud of my service in the United States Marine Corps. I spent 13 years on active duty. I come from a long line of Marines. My dad was a Marine and proudly served in defense of our country in the Korean War. My older brother was enlisted in the Marine Corps. He served in the infantry. And my younger brother was a captain in the Marine Corps. He served in the infantry. When I resigned my commission, I was a major. And the first half of my 13 years of service was in the infantry. I was in the first Persian Gulf War. And then while I was on active duty, I applied for and was accepted to a law program and attended Notre Dame Law School while on active duty, and then finished up the rest of my 13 years as a judge advocate. So it's very proud and honored to have served my country.
Well, thank you for serving. What attracted you to the Thomas More Law Center, or the TMLC, as we can refer to it?
When I took an oath of office as a Marine officer to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, you know, as I was defending the country against the foreign enemies, I realized that, you know, we do have domestic enemies to our Constitution. And one thing that I realized is that battle is not necessarily fought on battlegrounds with weapons, but is fought in the courtroom. And while I always thought I would serve a full 30 years on active duty in the Marine Corps as an infantry officer, I had a desire to defend our Constitution here in the court against our domestic enemies, and decided to go to law school, and went to Notre Dame Law School, and wanted to use those skills, again, in a way to defend the Constitution. And at that time, when I was looking to leave the service, having served as a judge advocate, the Thomas More Law Center was actually starting up in 2000, so it seemed to be the perfect fit. I was offered a job here, and I've been here ever since, for the last 10 years.
I watched a couple of the videos on your website, which is thomasmore.org, and that's Moore with one O. And, of course, that refers to a fellow from the, I guess, the 16th century. Is that right?
Yeah, St. Thomas More. He's the patron saint of lawyers. We obviously have a Catholic identity, but we defend all Christians. And St. Thomas More went to his death defending his faith. And he famously stated, as just before he was beheaded, that he's the king's good servant, but God's first. And so he is an inspiration for us, and he's the model for us, and that's exactly right. We're the king's good servant, but we're God's first, and that's where we place our priorities.
If I read correctly on your website, right now you're in the process of trying about 100 cases, is that right?
We have all sorts of, whether you call them cases or matters, at different levels of litigation. Some matters are handled simply by a demand letter. Others require, full-bore litigation and taking cases all the way up to including, getting the Supreme Court to try to take some of these cases. So that's probably about right, considering all the different areas that we handle all across the country, because we're based in Ann Arbor, Michigan, but we have a practice that is national in scope. And the other thing, too, is many of these cases, in fact, many of my cases, when we take them on, because we're trying to assert a legal principle, and we're going to, fight those battles all the way through up into including, trying to get the Supreme Court to rule on a matter. And these cases can take on a life of their own and can take up to 6 years to litigate. So we're always taking on new cases, but we're still fighting the cases that we, in many cases, have filed 6 years ago, 5 years ago. So the battle just continues to wage on, and there's many battles.
Are there any cases in existence since you joined the Law Center 10 years ago?
I think I finished all those out. I've got one that actually I'm going to be doing a cert petition, asking the Supreme Court to review a case out of California that we filed in 2004, and that's probably the oldest one. So this one's still going on, and I've got to file a petition for review in the U.S. Supreme Court in January. It's an interesting case. That was a case that worked its way through the system, and I was in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, which is out in California, and that case was heard en banc by the court, meaning the full court, and I did oral argument two Decembers ago before an 11-judge panel, which is a really unique experience, but it's a very interesting case defending Catholics out there in San Francisco, and they need a lot of a lot of defense out in San Francisco, and it's kind of sad when you think about it. The name of the city itself, San Francisco, is named after St. Francis.
A bit that's ironic, case, right?
A bit of bitter irony, I guess, if you want to describe it. And so that one is probably one of the oldest ones that I can think of, and so that's a 6-year shelf life right now, but it's not over yet. So
right.
It'll be going on to 7 years here coming up next year.
Now, you mentioned going all the way up to the Supreme Court. There was a case that I read about on the internet in New Jersey where the school, I guess, didn't want Christmas carols being sung. Can you tell our listeners about that?
Right. That was another case, I believe it was initiated in 2004 as well. The school district for many years, and it's South Orange Maplewood School District, and it's a relatively affluent area from my understanding and from my experience. And they have a very successful music program there and have for many, many years. And for many, many years, the Brass Ensemble and all these other different organizations, the Martin Luther King Gospel Choir, they performed the sort of classical Christmas music during the holiday season. They performed Hanukkah music as well during this this period of time, in concerts in school and out of school, and really all across the state. From my understanding, they have a very talented music program. Well, in 2004, I guess the Grinch stole Christmas. They revised their policy where they no longer allowed the performance of traditional Christmas music during the holiday season, including simple instrumentals. So it wasn't even a matter of singing the words to some of these traditional Christmas carols and Christmas songs, but they couldn't even play the instrumentals. So we challenged that on the Establishment Clause grounds, because according to the Supreme Court, the Establishment Clause doesn't allow the government to promote or endorse a particular religion or religious belief, but similarly, it cannot be hostile toward or disfavor a particular religion or religious belief, and it's hard to, the government must be neutral. So it's hard to, how you can describe a policy that prohibits a certain class of music, and the only reason why it's prohibited is not for any educational reasons or educational goals, because in fact it undermines sort of a solid music curriculum to not allow this sort of traditional and classic form of music. So there really was no educational goal in doing so, and the only reason was because it was related to a religious holiday, which, when you really think about it, Christmas is a national holiday as well. I mean, it's recognized by the federal government. So it's a music associated, traditional music associated with the national holiday, but because it was religious, it was excluded, and for no other reason. And I can't think of a better example of a policy that is not neutral toward religion, since the only thing it does is disfavor religion. Well, the district court disagreed with us, and so did the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, which sits in Philadelphia. That's the appellate court level. And one of the alarming parts of the Third Circuit ruling was, towards the end, the judges essentially said, well, I remember, all this traditional music being played when I was, going through public schools. We all, we all can remember those carols being sung and during that time of year, but things have changed. And, because things have changed, so does these, traditions, and no longer should these traditions, continue in these school districts. And if the school districts want to stop them for no other reason than they promote a particular religion, whether it be Christianity or Judaism with Hanukkah, then the school district can do so without violating the Establishment Clause. So that was somewhat troubling. We asked the Supreme Court to grant review of the case to take it up, because the Supreme Court's Establishment Clause jurisprudence is really muddled and is causing lots of confusion in the lower courts, and unfortunately the end result typically is whatever may be considered to favor religion is out. Anything that is anti-religion is okay. So it's really, the Establishment Clause now has become a blunt instrument against anything that is considered religious, and the Supreme Court needs to take up a significant Establishment Clause case and get this all worked out. We were hoping that was one they would have taken, but they didn't. They only take a fraction of the cases, because their review of these cases is discretionary. They can take it or they don't have to take it, and they don't even have to give you a reason as to why they decided one way or the other, and they didn't take it. So that case is essentially over. It's disappointing, and we'll see what happens. Usually around this time of year, we keep getting a lot of calls about sort of these anti-Christmas, anti-Christian policies. We haven't gotten so many so far yet this year, so I'm not sure if that's a good sign or a bad sign. It's hard to necessarily judge whether people are just, rolling over, sort of the frog in the, the boiling water, just slowly accepting this erosion of our national traditions, or maybe it's hopefully the other way around, that they're not. But I guess that story still has to be written.
for our listeners, that's the Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution, right?
That's right. The Establishment Clause where Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. That is all it says. And that's been, even though the language itself specifically refers to Congress, because its history is such that they didn't want to have a national church. At the time the Establishment Clause was part of the First Amendment was passed, state had their own state churches. For example, I grew up in Massachusetts. We have these congregational church halls, which were effectively state churches, and they apparently didn't violate the Establishment Clause because they were in existence when the Establishment Clause was passed. But the Supreme Court has since taken the entire First Amendment and incorporated it as applying against the states, even though the language says Congress shall not, applied it against the states through the 14th Amendment, through what is called as the Incorporation Doctrine. So I don't want to go too far afield on some of these legal matters, but you know, your listeners may be scratching their head and say, okay, Congress shall make no law, but how is it that the states, you know, it applies to the states? Well, that's how they do it. They did it through the 14th Amendment, through what is called the Incorporation Doctrine, long after the First Amendment was drafted, because obviously the 14th Amendment wasn't even drafted until after the Civil War. So anyways, that's how we're dealing with the Establishment Clause now. And you know, it's rather, you know, nonsensical when you think about it, and it really has become a blunt instrument against religion. You know, the Establishment Clause is what is typically used by the ACLU and these other organizations to prohibit small towns from putting up their traditional nativity scene during Christmas, or from the display of the Ten Commandments in a courtroom, for example. I mean, all these cases that I'm sure your listeners are somewhat familiar with, it's usually the Establishment Clause that's being used to tear down, you know, crosses for war memorials and so forth. You know, we're trying to push back.
Crosses in the middle of the desert. I read something about that.
Which was a war memorial. That was the we filed an amicus brief in that case. And that, in fact, we're the ones that so far have been successfully defending the Mount Soledad cross in San Diego, a cross that's been up since the Korean War. It's a war memorial. There was a long battle with this atheist who sued the city of San Diego to have that cross taken down. And we got involved in that litigation around, I think it was 2006, 2007, and were able to actually thwart the removal of that cross. In fact, that's a really interesting case, because that one, there had been an injunction for many years that the court never enforced, and the atheist finally got tired of it not being enforced, and the court issued an order telling the city of San Diego to remove the Mount Soledad cross, which is a 50-some-odd foot cross with all these plaques around it representing individual service members who, many of them, were killed in action, and or else they were going to be fined $5,000 a day. And the city, you know, was literally, the city is literally financially bankrupt, and they didn't have any choice, and they were going to take it down. We got involved and filed a request to the Ninth Circuit to have that decision to remove the cross stayed until we could get the case reviewed on appeal. Ninth Circuit declined that, and we took the extraordinary step of filing a request to Justice Kennedy of the Supreme Court. There's a provision under the rules where you can seek a review of an order to get a stay by a single justice, and it's each justice is responsible for the different circuits. Justice Kennedy happened to be responsible for the Ninth Circuit, which includes California. That was literally a Hail Mary pass, and we filed that request. We convinced the city to do similarly. We filed it on behalf of this veterans organization, and it literally shortly before the cross was to come down pursuant to the district court's order, Justice Kennedy stayed it, and the cross remains today. And we were successful in getting Congress to pass legislation, which was actually passed unanimously, even by the Democrats, to have the cross transferred from state property to federal property and become part of a national memorial. The federal government took over the property that the cross was on at Mount Soledad, because the lower court ruling that it was unconstitutional was based on the California Constitution, which is more quote-unquote separatist, meaning it's more anti-religion than the federal constitution. So we got the cross declared a national memorial, got it transferred to federal property, and then we got the Ninth Circuit to dismiss the other lawsuit as being moot because it was no longer on state property. And then promptly the ACLU filed a lawsuit against the federal government to get the cross removed, and that litigation is still ongoing. So
they don't rest.
No. And, you know, that's the thing that people need to realize. They don't. And we have to be as dedicated, as persistent as they are in wanting to destroy our traditions as we are to protect them. And so, you know, that's the main reason why we exist. You described, you know, what we're about at the beginning of this interview, and that's exactly right. And it, you know, takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of effort. And as you indicate, you know, we do this all pro bono. And, you know, we rely on the people who give us the, you know, the $25 donations and so forth. That's all the clients that we represent, these people who are willing to stand up and be plaintiffs in our lawsuit, we don't charge them a penny for our legal fees. And in many cases, they, you know, can be up to $1 million by the time we're done litigating a case for 6 years. But, you know, we're a public interest law firm, and we, you know, we rely on people who like what we do, rely on their support.
Right, and that's actually how I was turned on to your organization. It was a friend of mine. He makes regular donations to you, and he sent me an email. I guess he's on your email list. He was telling me about you for, several months, and he sent me an email about this case in Dearborn, Michigan, and that's really what caught my attention. And by the way, he donates like $5-$10 a month. It's not a huge amount, but he's proud to do it, and he's proud to be supporting Thomas More Law Center.
So. You know, that's one of the things that I'm somewhat proud about is that the vast majority of our donors are the people who give us, you know, $10, $15, $20, $25 a month. And those really, to me, those are the grassroots people. Those are the true Americans who are out there and working hard and don't like what's going on and sometimes feel like they don't have a voice at the national level or in the courts or in these major cases. And we can provide that for them. And you know, the fact that we have those sorts of donors those are really the heart and soul of America, is those people who are working hard and trying to make a difference with their family and don't necessarily have a lot of money, but they're the ones that we rely on. We've been blessed to have people like that, like your friend, who continue to support our work.
And of course, these are the people that want the traditional America to remain, what they grew up in, America, and is disappearing, as you're saying. Now, this case was in Dearborn, Michigan, where about a third of the population identify themselves as Muslims. Is that correct?
It's the home of Henry Ford, and it actually boasts the largest concentration of Muslims, largest Muslim population in the entire United States. So it is heavily influenced by Muslims and Islam.
Right.
And then each year, in the last 15 years, Dearborn has held this annual festival. It's an Arab festival, the Dearborn Arab International Festival, which attracts many Arabs, Muslims from across the country. It's very large. I think they estimate about 200,000 people come over the weekend into the city of Dearborn for this festival.
A lot.
And there's a lot. And as a result, that actually is a place where a lot of Christian missionaries come from all across the United States to evangelize at this public festival, which takes place on the city streets, which leads us to what happened in last year, the case that you're referring to. Four Christian missionaries that I represent, Nabil Qureshi, who himself is a convert from Islam. His family is still Muslim. He loves his family members very, very much. But he'll tell you very plainly that the best decision he ever made in his life was to convert to Christianity, and he wants to share the gospel with his, really fellow Muslims. And Dearborn is a good place for him to do that. He's part of an organization called Acts 17 Apologetics, which has its particular ministry toward Muslims. And a little more background about Nabil Qureshi. He has his MD, and he's currently in a graduate program in religious studies at Duke University. So hardly sort of your rabble-rouser type. One of the other members of this group, David Wood, who's also a member of Acts 17 Apologetics, he's from New York, and David is a professor of philosophy at Fordham University. He, at one point in his life, was an atheist and became a Christian, and for him as well, being a Christian was the most important decision he ever made in his entire life. And so, in his spare time, per se, as a college professor, he also goes around with Nabil Qureshi and seeking to evangelize and preach the gospel of Jesus.
Right.
A third member of this group was Paul Rizkala. Paul is an 18-year-old junior at New York University. He started college when he was 16. He's an exceedingly bright young man, as you could imagine. And he's an Arab himself, but a Christian. He's Egyptian. And again, he has a desire to evangelize. And then the fourth person in the group was Nagin Mayel, who's a young 18-year-old college student from Texas. And she, again, similarly has the same desire. Well, they went to the Dearborn Arab Festival this past June in 2010. And they went there to discuss their faith with individuals who want to discuss their faith. In fact, they brought with them small handheld cameras because they had experiences in the past where people would make false claims about, how they were evangelizing or whether they were, causing any disturbance and so forth. And so
right.
They brought the cameras for really two reasons. They have an incredible website where they videotape a lot of their dialogue and discussions and their street preaching. Not only do street preaching, they actually engage in, you know, significant debates at colleges, universities, and places all across the country. I mean, these are very talented individuals and very sharp, and they're very skilled in their ability to evangelize in ways that when people tend to be hostile towards them, which they can be, they're very disarming and they're very eloquent in the way they discuss their faith. And you can even see some of these videos. You go to our website or their website, Act 17 Apologetics, you can see some of the videos at the Dearborn Festival, and very peaceful in the way they engage people, even when some people were very hostile towards them and using profanity. Nabil in particular is very disarming in his very peaceful and loving way that he discusses his faith.
They turn the other cheek.
They certainly do, and you know, and they use the video because they put it on YouTube because their view is, look, we use the mass media to get the gospel across to people. I mean, just like this interview on, you know, is going to find its way on the internet. More people, rather than just you and I being witnesses or participants in this conversation, by putting it on the internet and using other media, other people can listen to it and perhaps learn or want to seek more information. So when you have a street dialogue or street preaching, you might have one, two, or you know, three or four people who are involved in the dialogue, but if you can videotape that dialogue and then put it on YouTube, thousands, even millions of people can see that and can you know, can learn from that. And so they do this as part of their, you know, right to freedom of speech, right to the free exercise of religion. And they also, again, they also realize that, you know, people are, don't like them preaching the gospel, particularly to Muslims. And so they use the video cameras for their own protection to show what their activities are. And thankfully, that was the case, because they were literally preaching very peacefully to a small group of young Muslims, about 10 young men, towards the end of the Arab festival. And literally from out of the woodwork came multiple police officers who put them in handcuffs and took them away. It's actually remarkable. And if they go to our website, thomasmore.org, you can scroll through and do a search and look for the video of the arrest of Nabil Qureshi. And when you watch that video, you have to pause for a minute and think, did that just happen in the United States of America? Well, it did. And they were actually charged with a breach of the peace by the city of Dearborn. And we had a week-long criminal trial this past September and with a jury. And I defended all four of the Christian evangelists during this jury trial. And thankfully, late on that Friday, I think it was September 24th, we started on Monday, September 20th, the jury came back with a unanimous verdict of not guilty.
Right.
And they were actually quite relieved that they weren't going to seek jail time or have criminal convictions against them for literally just preaching the gospel on the city streets.
Was it a jury of their peers?
We spent a lot of time picking jury members. And very interestingly, you know, I had submitted to the court, because you do what's called voir dire, which is the questioning of the jurors to make sure that they're fair and impartial. And I wanted to ask questions about, you know, whether they were adherents to Sharia, whether they were, you know, what the, in terms of, from a religious perspective, because under Sharia law, which is Islamic law, if somebody who is a convert from Islam to Christianity, as two of the defendants in this case, Nabil and Nagin, were converts, they're apostates. And the penalty for that under Islamic law is death. So how can you have somebody sitting on a jury trying to judge them in this particular case when, in, based on that person's firm convictions and the law that he is obligated to follow, Sharia law, requires the person to face death? And also under Sharia law, a female's testimony in court is only half of that of a man's.
Amazing.
And so I wanted to get into that with the juror questions, and the court wouldn't let me. So, you know, there was one juror, although it's hard to know whether, because I couldn't ask the question. He was certainly Arab, but it wasn't clear whether he was a Muslim or not. And the others, just by, you know, by fortune, because they picked the numbers out of a, you know, out of a lottery.
Right.
None of them appeared to be Muslims, but regardless, the jury verdict was a complete acquittal on the breach of the peace. And right now we're preparing our civil lawsuit against the city for violating their constitutional rights. You know, our mantra at TMLC is, we're the sword and shield for people of faith. So we had to raise the shield at this point to defend against these bogus criminal charges, and we're going to be drawing the sword and suing the city for the civil rights violation. You know, very interestingly, throughout the trial, they were criticized for having the video cameras and going to video cameras, but if it wasn't for the video, when you saw what the police officers were testifying to, they were creating this riot, they were, you know, they were causing this huge disturbance of the peace with these giant crowds, and you played the video, none of that was true. None of it was true. They were claiming that, you know, Beale was shouting into the crowd and trying to cite them. Not true at all. And thankfully, Thankfully, we had the video for the jury to see what the police were testifying about was simply not true.
To see the truth, right?
You know, the thing is, though, and I wouldn't be surprised if next year they try to pass some rule or regulation that bans the use of video cameras in the festival. And we'll certainly challenge that. But, you know, that was, like I said, that was one of the things. They said, well, they were causing a disturbance of the peace because they had these video cameras. Well, you know, these weren't like, you know, TV4 big. These were small handheld video cameras. And quite frankly, people, you know, videotape with their iPhones and everything else. They were small, discreet, and the people were videotaping because Nabil was the one that was doing most of the discussing with the faith, and David would join in at times, but Paul would be standing back in a distance, and McGean would be standing back at a further distance to kind of get a broader view. And, you know, it was so fortunate that they did that, because then you have all these police officers saying that they were, you know, causing this disturbance, there was, you know, all these crowds gathering, there was a public safety issue. You know, and they certainly would testify and say, no, that wasn't true. But then you're balancing all these police officers' testimony against these individuals' testimony. Well, when you put up the video, there's no better way to see what actually happened than actually see it on video. So,
of course, and that's why there's police stations all across the United States now that are buying that new taser device that's a mini camera that's mounted on their person, and they can record everything. So it's obviously something that law enforcement thinks is a good idea. So why isn't it a good idea for individuals to do it, right?
No, exactly. And, you know, it's interesting. They want the cameras to go away, you know, shut off the cameras, because, quite frankly, the cameras were going to capture police misconduct, which, in fact, it did in this particular case. So it's a very interesting, you know, some of the mantra and some of the coverage of this talk about Sharia law. And, you know, it's very interesting when you think about what Sharia law is. And you know, I'm not going to state here that, you know, they've incorporated Sharia law as part of an ordinance or and so forth. But when you look at the influence of Sharia in the city of Dearborn, where you have these Christian missionaries whose only crime really was to dare to go to a Muslim festival to preach their faith, a festival that was open to the general public that occurred on a city street, which is all that they were doing. But under Sharia law, the only religion you're allowed to preach is Islam. So it's very interesting how the influences in that city, how it is influencing, you know, the government officials, the festival workers, and everybody else, to the point where they would take these four Christian missionaries, put them in handcuffs, take them away, and they literally spent the entire night in jail. They were bailed out the next morning on $500 bonds apiece. And when you watch that video, and it's a lot of it's on YouTube, you can go to our website and see the arrests of these individuals and see what they were doing. It is startling, it is remarkable, it is frightening, and it's hard to believe that that actually happened here in the United States.
If Thomas More Law Center wasn't there, if you weren't there to defend these folks, and they went to jail, paid their fines, submitted to what law enforcement wanted them to submit to, could that have sent a bad signal, you think?
Sure, because what it does is it emboldens the police officers, it emboldens the Muslim festival organizers who, you know, no question in my mind were, you know, influencing the police to take those actions. So, and, you know, it's interesting because even my clients, I mean, they're, you know, the three of them are college students, one's a college professor, you know, they said quite frankly that there's no way they could have afforded to defend themselves against these, against these criminal charges. And we're very thankful that we could step in and do it and represent them at no charge. The city really had an axe to grind on this. For a misdemeanor breach of the peace, even the prosecutor, you know, commented to me, he's never had one of these cases last more than a day. This thing was five full days of testimony and legal battles throughout. So it was, you know, this was a hard-fought battle. The city really wanted these individuals prosecuted to make a point, and we wanted them acquitted to similarly make a point. And thankfully, you know, here in the United States, you know, truth did prevail. And again, we're gonna continue to pursue this because we don't want it to happen again. And really, the only way to truly prevent this from happening again is to bring a civil rights action and to get an injunction and to get a court to affirmatively declare what they did as a violation of the Constitution. And that's what we're going to be doing.
Right. So you guys are kind of like the anti-ACLU.
Exactly. The ACLU has been seeking since the 30s to deconstruct the United States and deconstruct our Constitution, and we're trying to do just the opposite. In fact, we're at the point now that it's a tidal wave that you're trying to stop. So, you know, we're trying to stop the tidal wave and also try to rebuild some of the founding principles of our Constitution. And,
right.
You know, we take that very seriously. And as I indicated to you, you know, early on, you know, this is a battle. It's, you know, I changed from out of my, you know, my camouflage utilities and put my M16A2 aside, and I put on a suit and tie and I take my law degree, and I'm still fighting the same battle. I'm just doing it in a different form.
Right. This is kind of like an anti-crusades almost.
It's a crusade to defend our Constitution, is I guess the way I would look at it.
Yeah, they're coming after the Christians.
And there's no question. You know, what I say to other people, and you know, some people I would get offended. Well, what do you mean, you know, Christian or Judeo-Christian? There's other religions. I said, look, you know what? The reality is, and I was on Alan Colmes' radio show. We had this, you know, debate about about the Christian influence and so forth. In fact, one of the things that he said to me, which was very startling, I said to him, I posed the question. He was saying, well, you know, we can't have any religion. This, you know, wall of separation, church and state, which, you know, doesn't appear anywhere in the Constitution.
Right.
And I said, Alan, you know, based on your view, the Declaration of Independence, which refers to Creator, would be unconstitutional. And he paused and he said, well, I'll have to think about that for a minute. And I'm like, you have to think about that for a minute? You have to even, the thought that these, you know, these anti-religious liberals, that even in their mind, they could even consider the fact that our Declaration of Independence could violate the U.S. Constitution? I mean, that's just crazy. But I told him, I said, Alan, whether you're a Christian or not, you benefit from the fact that our nation was founded on those values. Because we respect the right of conscience. How many mosques are there, for example, in the United States? Countless numbers of mosques. How many Christian churches are there in, you know, Iran or Saudi Arabia or any of these other, you know, Sharia countries? I can tell you, there are none.
Right. They'll be beheaded if they touch a Bible.
You know, and here's the thing. You know, we went over, as I mentioned, I was in the first Persian Gulf War, you know, defending against the invasion of Kuwait by, you know, Saddam's forces from Iraq. And we would, you know, go ashore at different locations and some of our allies. And we were told, as, you know, service members who were there, you know, really defending a lot of these Arab nations, that if we had, you know, if we were wearing crucifixes or wearing any other religious medals and things, we had to put them away. We had to hide them while we were there. They couldn't be seen.
Amazing.
It was amazing, and I found that exceedingly offensive.
Is there a real danger if TMLC doesn't remain ever vigilant? Is there a real danger that Sharia law could take root in a place like Dearborn, Michigan?
Well, you know, to me, there's no question, and it wouldn't be, and it's not something that's going to be, you know, full-fledged, full force. And let me just make this point. You know, those Islamic terrorists who were flying planes into buildings were doing so pursuant to Sharia law. When they talk about, you know, radical Islam, and it's really, it's Sharia-based, and it's not that radical. It is the Orthodox Islam is based on Sharia law. And those individuals that are flying the planes were involved in, you know, violent jihad. Well, there's more than just violent jihad that's going on. There's also what some people have coined stealth jihad. You know, we have a lawsuit involving the bailout of AIG, which we're actually waiting for a decision here shortly. AIG is the world leader in Sharia-compliant financing, where these insurance programs have to comply with Sharia law, and part of the Sharia component of that is they can't involve any risk, and certain profits that are made through the course of this Sharia-compliant financing, that money has to be paid as a religious tax, what they call as a zakat, or there has to be some purification of that money, and the way they purify it, or the way they pay that religious tax, is it goes to a qualified, quote-unquote, Islamic charity, which many of those, like the Holy Land Foundation and some of these others, are direct supporters of Hamas and Hezbollah and these other terrorist organizations. So here is AIG, which you and I, as federal taxpayers, own 80% of it.
Right.
We've given them countless billions of dollars of federal tax money, and this money is going to fund Sharia-compliant financing, you know, all across the world. And so there's other things that we have to be exceedingly vigilant, that it's not just, you know, people flying planes into buildings, but there's other components of this. And you know, you just look across the spectrum of things that are rising, that anytime you say something, you know, negative about Islam, it's all of a sudden you become an intolerant and you're being shut down. So even freedom of speech is being stifled. So it's, I mean, there's other ways that this sort of, you know, concept of Sharia is creeping into our culture that we have to be careful about. And it's, you know, it's not just, you know, armed rebellion or, again, you know, violent jihad. There's more subtle ways in which it's creeping in that we got to be very careful.
And is this AIG case, is this on your website?
The different press releases and things that you can find. It's a great, we filed this right after the, shortly after the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act was passed, where, you know, billions of dollars went to the AIG bailout. The Department of Justice immediately filed what's called a motion to dismiss and said, look, this isn't even, you know, stating a claim, and a lot of the naysayers saying, oh, look, this thing will never, you know, never prevail. Well, the judge ruled in our favor in a terrific opinion, denying the motion to dismiss, and said, look, based on all the facts that were alleged, this is a violation of the Constitution. You can't have taxpayer money going to fund a religious activity such as Sharia-compliant financing. AIG even has to hire a Sharia advisory board, or these imams and these others, to make determinations whether or not the investments comport with Sharia law. And then we took discovery for about a year, and both parties filed what's called cross-motion motions for summary judgment earlier this summer, and we're waiting any day now for the judge to rule. And if he follows his prior ruling, the original ruling was based on the allegations in the complaint. Well, during the course of discovery, we proved the allegations in the complaint by tracing the money, showing how taxpayer funds were going to support these various subsidies of AIG who engage in Sharia-compliant financing. And so if he follows the logic of his prior ruling, we're hopefully optimistic that he's going to issue a final decision in our favor that the portions of the AIG bailout violated the U.S. Constitution.
Explain to our listeners what discovery is.
You take depositions, you make document requests. When you originally file your lawsuit, your complaint is based on allegations. You know, you do as much as you can in terms of due diligence to, you know, determine what the facts are that you're basing your legal claims upon. Well, after you get through the pleading, which is just that it's a pleading, it's allegations, you have to set about proving those allegations. And you do that by, you know, taking depositions. We took depositions of Treasury officials. We got affidavits from members of AIG, which is, you know, a sworn statement. We made document requests. You can subpoena documents, you can, you know, subpoena people to give testimony and so forth. And then once you get through that and you get the sworn testimony, the documents, that's discovery. So now you go about proving your case. So you go from allegations to actual proving through facts, through testimony, documents, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so summary judgment motions are then based on the facts that were discovered during the course of discovery.
You dig up the facts in discovery, and then you could file for what's called, as you said, summary judgment to avoid going to trial because the facts are right in front of everybody's face.
Right. The summary judgment essentially, look, there are no genuine issues of material fact. Now, there may be some disputes around the margins, but what are the material facts? Is there a dispute over these material facts? And if there's no material dispute over these material facts, then you argue, look, based on these undisputed material facts, that we should win as a matter of law. And so we said, you know, we presented what we believe to be the material facts. The government presented what they believe to be the material facts. And we both said, look, judge, based on these facts, you know, we should win as a matter of law. And the judge will then look at all of this, and he'll first have to determine whether or not there is a material dispute of facts. And if there is, then the case goes to trial. If there's not, then he'll say, okay, based on these facts that are material and that there is no dispute, what does the law say should happen?
Some of these prominent cases, we just talked about Dearborn, Michigan, most populous Muslim city in the United States of America. There was a case we talked about earlier in South Orange, Maplewood. I'm from New Jersey, and that is a wealthy area, as you indicated. It's also got a high concentration of not Muslims, but those of the Jewish faith. Also, Palm Beach was a prominent case of yours I saw on your website, which also has a high concentration of those of the Jewish faith. Is this a battle between Christians, Jews, and Muslims? It seems like the ACLU has a high concentration of Jewish attorneys. Is this something that is going to be going on because it's that eternal battle that mimics Jerusalem?
My co-counsel, who is a great lawyer and has become a great friend, we're handling the AIG case together. We also have one of the premier lawsuits against the healthcare and probably about a half dozen other cases, is David Yerushalmi, who's an Orthodox Jew out of New York City. The ACLU has many, I think, secular Jews who don't like Orthodox Jews and don't like Christians.
Right.
So I think authentic, sort of, you know, people often refer to as the J.O. Christian, and I think that's fairly accurate. I think there's much that Orthodox Jews and Christians have in common, more so than in a way that I think, you know, we can partner to defend the many values that we share here in the United States. I think there are many that are, you know, quote unquote secular Jews who I think line up with the ACLU, who tend to be very liberal, who discard the orthodoxy of their religion, you know, who are pro-homosexual rights, who are pro-abortion, who in many respects don't like this country. And I think, you know, they tend to be on the same side as the Muslims. I very much embrace my Orthodox Jewish friend from New York, who's a fabulous counsel, and I'll partner with him any day to handle these cases, and he shares the same view as I do. In fact, he's said many times that, you know, as an Orthodox Jew, he's very grateful and thankful that this is a Christian nation, because he can exercise his religion here freely in this country, and he respects the Christian heritage of our nation. So I would alter your premise slightly in that regard, and like I said, I've got personal experience working with my Orthodox Jew friend, my brother from New York, and we've got about a half a dozen cases that are, you know, really defending the Christian and Judeo-Christian heritage of this country.
Right. We can't paint it with a broad brush, but can we say that it is a battle of religions?
I would say there's a spiritual battle going on. There's no question. It's a spiritual battle, and I think it's good and evil, and that's where it's at. And you know, I think the Sharia adherent Muslims, they want their religion to dominate in a way that they want to create this caliphate, which is, you know, totally contrary to our view of you know the right of conscience and so forth. And I think there certainly is a battle in that regard, but I think it's, you know, but I think at bottom it is a battle of good and evil. You know, people describe the ACLU as the devil's advocate, and I would concur with that.
If listeners are interested in joining the fight, what can they do?
There's an old saying, you know, from the military that, you know, amateurs think tactics and professionals think logistics. You know, we always, at the end of the day, we need financial support to do what we're doing. And every bit matters. I mean, there's no question about it. We've been blessed and we continue to be blessed, and I'm very thankful for that. They go to our website. There's a number of things. They can, you know, if it's on their heart to donate to us, it's certainly much appreciated. Our clients appreciate it as well. You can sign up for our email alert so you can, you know, keep informed about what is going on. If you know of a situation that's occurring in your town or city or state that just doesn't seem right, and you might need somebody to get involved, you can refer a case to us, go online and, you know, send it to us, and, you know, given our resources, and if it fits our mission, we'll look at it. You know, many of our cases come that way. So having people who are vigilant, just, you know, keeping abreast of what is going on by getting our email alerts and checking us out on the website. And again, if it moves you to want to support what we're doing, then we're also grateful for that. We also, for those who are attorneys who are listening, they can sign up to be a pro bono affiliate attorney, because we have handled cases literally in every state across the country, and we often, because we're not licensed in all those states, you can get admitted to handle a particular case, what's called pro hoc vice. But to do that, you have to have a sponsoring local attorney. We have some in the neighborhood of 500 plus pro bono attorneys all across the country who help us out in various jurisdictions to alert us of cases or to help us by sponsoring our admission into that case and many other ways. So there's different ways that you can help out, and not to say the least is just lifting this all up in prayer and asking for God's blessing and grace on everything that we're trying to do.
And of course, that's thomasmoore.org, and that's Moore with one O. Tell our listeners how much that one case you detailed earlier, the Dearborn, Michigan, cost.
It's in about $100,000 plus at this point, and that was just for the defending them at the criminal trial. The civil lawsuit is going to be a knockdown, drag out battle because we're bringing everybody into this, from the mayor to the chief of police and everyone else. And that case is going to take several years, and I would not be surprised if that case would rack up somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 million in attorney's fees by the time it's all done.
I'll be watching that carefully. I want to thank you, Robert Muse, Senior Trial Counsel for the Thomas Moore Law Center. That's thomasmoore.org. I want to wish you a great holiday season.
Well, thank you very much. You have a very Merry Christmas.